we're thinking about how to create an economy in which workers from all different backgrounds with all different skills and abilities can be able to sustain a family and contribute to a healthy and vibrant community. So we're looking at the American worker and how that economic pie is divvied up and then enlarged. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. How do you create the social and economic conditions for a robust labor market in which all people can contribute and be paid fairly for their part? Join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. This question about divvying up the economic pie is one that Orrin Kass is working on. He is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research. He previously worked as domestic policy director for Mitt Romney's presidential campaign and as an editor of the Harvard Law Review. His new book is out. It's called The Once and Future Worker, A Vision for the Renewal of Work in America. Orrin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So you say that the American worker is in crisis. Can you give us some measurements to base this on? Where are workers redlining?
Well, I think there are a couple of economic indicators that are important to look at. One is what's called labor force participation, which is just, do you even say you're in the job market and even want a job? And there, for men in particular, we've seen declining and increasingly steep declines over time, so much so that even now during, you know, what most economists would say is kind of the peak of a pretty strong boom, we've got close to 20% of men in the primes of their working ages who aren't even looking for work. And of course that's heavily concentrated towards those who are less educated. And so in, you know, more rural areas among less educated populations, those numbers go much higher. So that's one source of concern. A second is just to look at wages and to see that for a very long time now, really going all the way back to the 70s, wages for the median worker, wages for workers with less than a college degree, really haven't moved very much. It wouldn't be accurate to say they've gone down necessarily, but as we've seen all of this enormous growth and progress in the economy, that really hasn't flowed down to higher pay for large segments of the workforce. And so I think those are some of the economic facts you start with, and then from there you can look ahead to what that's meaning for our society and to, you know, the collapse of family structure in a lot of cases, to the collapse of communities, and now even to things like declining health. You know, we've now had three straight years of declining life expectancy in this country, and the last time that happened was 100 years ago. It took a world war and a global flu pandemic to have the kind of effect that we're seeing now. So I think there are a lot of red lights that are flashing.
And so then Democrats and Republicans take different policy approaches to look and attack some of these problems. You say Democrats, the focus is, we've heard, on increasing the safety net and expanding health care entitlements. Republicans, it's about lowering taxes and shrinking the government. But ultimately, they're both trying to work on the same thing and to keep growing the GDP, gross domestic product, and really growing that economic pie. But in some ways, do their approaches miss the mark?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I think it does miss the mark. And, you know, as you've said, Republicans and Democrats have obviously disagreed and fought about a lot for all time. But really going back to about the 1960s, we've underlying that had a very strong consensus that what we were trying to do was, as you said, grow the economic pie, the idea that the economy is sort of this thing that you want it to get bigger so that everybody can consume more. And if only certain people are really involved in that growth directly, then you can always redistribute. And so we've had lots of big fights about how to get the fastest possible growth. We've had lots of big fights about how to then redistribute and how much to redistribute. But at the end of the day, all of that is about consumption. All of that is about making sure that everybody's consumption and living standards rise. And certainly those things are important. I'm not against growth or rising living standards, but it's important to recognize what that leaves out. And what that leaves out is the worker side of it. Or, you know, to take the metaphor much too far, it ignores the question of who's baking the pie. And if work really matters, if being a productive contributor, not just being able to consume, really matters to people's lives, then to a pretty large extent, we've been focused on the wrong thing. And I don't think we should be surprised that, you know, in a sense, we got what we wanted, but we didn't want the right thing.
Orrin Cass is with us. He's author of the book, The Once and Future Worker. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Where do you see your own work situation perhaps improving, perhaps falling short? Do you feel a high level of productivity? What does that feel like? What public policy can improve the labor market? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Orrin, when we see greater and greater consumption, though, why doesn't more consumption help all people?
Well, more consumption does help all people in some respects, and, you know, certainly getting to sort of a minimum threshold of consumption to make sure you have food and shelter and medical care and so forth is very important. But when you look from a lot of different perspectives at what's actually most important in people's lives, it's not consumption. If you look at what drives people's personal satisfaction and happiness, their, you know, even their mental health, their self-esteem, those things are tied much more closely to being to having work, to being productive contributors, to supporting their families, to having a role to play in their communities. And certainly it's also critical to their own economic opportunity. You know, you can sustain somebody at a given level, typically barely at the poverty line, through transferring consumption to them. But then you're going to have to do it again next year. It's not something that they can really build on. So from the individual's perspective, I think, you know, actually work is incredibly important. But then also it's incredibly important for family, you know, especially for men. Work is closely tied to families forming in the first place. Unemployment is very closely tied to divorce. And then work is also really important for outcomes for kids. Kids tend to have better outcomes when they're growing up in households where they have a parent that's working. And even more broadly, kids have better outcomes just when they're growing up in a community where more of the adults are engaged in work. So as we sort of think about, you know, what are the things we care about most? What are the things we need to have a healthy society? And a society that's building and progressing over time for everybody, the consumption answer, just cutting everyone a big enough piece of the pie, isn't the right answer. It has to be a model that actually makes sure that as we grow and progress, which we certainly want to do, which we need to do, we're doing it in a way that is still inclusive of everybody in the labor market.
And in that inclusivity, how does the productive worker fit into that? Because we can measure productivity in different ways.
Well, sure. I mean, I think, you know, at the end of the day, productivity is going to turn out to be tied pretty closely to what people can earn. So if we want to see wages rising, we also need to see productivity going up. But more broadly than that, you know, I think it's really important to recognize that when we're talking about why work matters and why work is important, it's important that people feel like they're actually doing something of value. So, you know, they're, from time to time, you'll hear solutions that, you know, well, maybe kind of the labor market isn't going to work for everybody, but we can essentially sort of, you know, create and make work jobs for people. Some people have said maybe video games can give you the same sense of accomplishment. And that's not really true. We need to actually be productive. It's really important to how people think about themselves.
Orrin Cass is author of the book, The Once and Future Worker, gathering your insights on the working person in America today. 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. As we're looking at the state of work in America, we can drive this conversation home to Wisconsin with a look at Foxconn and the way policymakers can influence the labor market. It's possible that the subsidies for Foxconn could reach $4.7 billion as it builds its LCD manufacturing plant and looks to employ up to 13,000 workers in Wisconsin. What do you think about the role of government in the Foxconn deal? What do you wonder about in how public policy can affect the labor market? Do you see things in the workforce that correlate to particular policies put in place by our government? 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Orrin Cass stays with us. His book is called The Once and Future Worker, and he's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research. Orrin, looking at Foxconn here for a moment, building a $10 billion manufacturing facility in southwest Wisconsin, we've seen the subsidies, the dollars there. There is a robust incentive package, some say the largest in history for a state. Is this good public policy when it comes to growing the labor force?
I think the Foxconn case, it's a fascinating example, and I think there are two really important lessons in it. One is that I don't think it's very good public policy. And the reason is that I don't know that it makes sense to pick a single company to provide that kind of support to. I mean, obviously, there's any number of manufacturers in Wisconsin. There's any number of other manufacturers that might or might not want to move to Wisconsin. And there's any number of other states that might or might not want Foxconn and other manufacturers to move there. And if we go company by company and have a bidding war and a political fight about who we want to support how much, it's certainly not something that I think we should have a lot of faith our politicians are going to do especially well. And I don't think ultimately it's going to produce the best sort of range of investment for our economy. At the same time, I think there's an incredibly important lesson to learn in how eager people are to have a Foxconn come and how much, policymakers are willing to essentially spend on that, because what it says is, this really matters. There's really very large value to our society in having a big manufacturer set up shop. And that's something, for all of the rhetoric that politicians have always delivered, that's something that our public policy has actually ignored. I mean, when you look at, for instance, the way we do regulation and something like the environment, everyone celebrates that we do these very careful, what are called cost-benefit analyses, but we don't actually consider what value, if any, manufacturing employment has when we're setting our environmental regulations. Or when you look at the way we do trade policy, we've very explicitly taken the position that it doesn't matter whether manufacturers are here or somewhere else, and we don't care where they go. So I think it's important to recognize that when communities, when states are actually put to the test, they really do care, and we should take notice of that and incorporate it in how we try to grow the economy.
You talk about trade-offs in your book as well, and looking at trade-offs with Foxconn, there's certainly the impact to the state coffers, impact to environmental wetlands. Governor Evers has said, the new governor, Tony Evers, says he'll renegotiate a deal to ensure that Foxconn is a, quote, good corporate citizen. What is a good corporate citizen, and how does that speak to the future of workers in America?
Well, that's a very broad question. I mean, I think, as a preliminary matter, I'd note another reason you don't want to be doing these company by company deals is then you bring in a new administration and now they want to renegotiate it, right? That's not something that businesses are going to look kindly upon, and now it adds a whole new dimension to our politics and who we're putting in office in the first place. And so that dynamic is a difficult one, but the question of what is it to be a good corporate citizen is incredibly important. And so, attentiveness to environmental impacts, I think, is certainly one component of that. Attentiveness to how firms treat workers, whether they're try to be accommodating and reasonable in terms of what they expect of workers, taking account of the fact that workers have lives outside of work. I think all those things are very important, but then another huge piece of it, and it's why everyone was so excited to have Foxconn come, is employing a lot of people is really important. And one thing that I'm struck by, especially I do a lot of speaking on business school campuses, and I talk to business school students about, what is it you're planning to go do, and everyone sort of is they're taught aggressively about the importance of corporate social responsibility and making a difference in the world, and they all have that at the top of their list, and yet that tends to translate into going and working in technology and finance, or maybe fighting climate change, and doing things that really have no connection to workers, certainly to less skilled workers, certainly to finding ways to build enterprises that are going to use a lot of workers productively. And that's actually a huge part of what the role that businesses need to play in our society, and that we need to celebrate them for playing and say is one of the things that we're really looking for.
Talking with Orrin Kass, he's author of the new book, The Once and Future Worker, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you imagine work will look like 50 years from now? Do you think we'll be sharing a space with robots, or will we have lost some of our jobs to automation? How do you think we'll be making our living under new circumstances? 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Patrick now, joining us from Iron River. Hi, Patrick. Are you there, Patrick? Oh, I think we've lost Patrick. Basically, Patrick is wondering about bureaucrats in charge. It's just one more thing that business has to put up with, the overall cost in which they pass to consumers. And in terms of bureaucracy and regulation, Jim in Watertown had similar thoughts in saying, you know, how we regulate and put prices on things doesn't really even the playing field for the consumer or for society. Orrin, what do you make of that?
Well, the regulation question, I think, is an incredibly important one. That we have an incredible influence on what actually happens in our economy based on the rules we write. And, you know, historically, we've had a lot of fights where one side is for more regulation, one side is for less regulation. Obviously, an economy needs regulation, but the question is, how do we evaluate it? What do we want from it? And what do we recognize as its upsides and downsides? And so, you know, as we were talking about earlier with this question of do we think primarily in terms of consumers or in terms of workers, you know, historically the way we have evaluated regulation, again, is solely through the lens of a consumer. And we say, you know, providing better environmental quality, providing cleaner air, in a sense, that's something you consume, and we can put a dollar value on it and say you're better off because you have more of it. And that's true. Cleaner air is good, and people benefit from having more of it. But if that's the only side we look at, if we don't on the flip side say, you know, every time we turn the ratchet a little bit tighter to impose to impose stricter standards and higher costs in pursuit of cleaner air, we also make it that much harder to open a factory, to expand a factory, to do a big infrastructure project. Those things have real costs too. And so it all does come down to trade-offs and saying, where do we want to make the trade-offs? And when do we want to say, you know, obviously environmental quality is very important, but it's not always the only thing that's important. And sometimes you'd say, we don't want to go backwards, but you know, making even more progress on environmental quality might be further down our list, and making sure we're getting more investment in our industrial economy and creating the kinds of jobs where blue collar workers especially can be really productive and earn a good wage. That's actually really important for our society right now, and we want to put more of our emphasis there.
So as we look at those blue-collar workers, as we look at opening up a factory, where does automation fit into this picture of the future worker? Is automation taking jobs?
Well, automation is a good thing for workers. You know, automation is something that can sound scary, and certainly there are plenty of people out there saying it's going to be scary. But, you know, I thought it was funny when you said, are we going to be sharing our workspace with robots? We do, right? I mean, I'm sitting right here with a computer in front of me. You're sitting in a studio surrounded by electronic equipment, and most workers have for 30 or 40 years now. We go through incredible waves of technological progress, and while the ones that we see coming down the pike with robotics and artificial intelligence, you know, look both exciting and scary, They're not more exciting or scary than electricity or industrialization or the introduction of computers. All of these things have incredible effects and will change the way we do work. But ultimately, what they tend to do is make workers more productive. And I think the two key things to focus on when we talk about automation, one is that it happens really slowly.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine to say there's some technology in a lab at MIT that you think could replace a worker. But, you know, we had computers in labs at MIT in the 1940s and 50s, and we're still trying to figure out how to make them work in your local HR department. So it's going to take a long time. And very rarely does technology actually replace workers.
We got to pause right there. Oren Kass of the Manhattan Institute. His book is The Once and Future Worker. We're exploring the worker here in America. Getting your thoughts as well at 800-642-1234. What should be the minimum wage in America? Should we prioritize tax cuts or increase the minimum wage? Let's talk about it. We'll pick up the conversation after a news update on the Ideas Network. Democrats in Congress yesterday introduced a bill to gradually increase the federal minimum wage to $15 per hour from the current $7.25. And though it could get through the Democratic-controlled House, the Republican-held Senate likely will not approve it. President Trump will likely oppose it. What do you think, though, is a fair minimum wage? Is there a solution to raising it to $15, or is the answer something bigger than that? Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Oren Kass is our guide to the conversation on labor in America and how to achieve an economic pie that doesn't leave people behind. His book is The Once and Future Worker, and he's a senior fellow at the think tank, the Manhattan Institute. Let's go back to the phones now with Paul joining us from Milwaukee. Paul, what's on your mind?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to touch on something that your guest did bring up about workers feeling valued in the workplace, in their community. And from my position, what I've seen happen, and I've been in manufacturing for, oh my goodness, over 35 years. And what I've observed is that at one time, manufacturing was designed to make a good product. And in the not too distant past, that became superseded by the desire to create profit for shareholders. And that desire for that profit started wheedling away at the value of the product that was being made. And the workers recognized this. And what happens is that the workers start to lose pride in what they're making.
Paul, thank you so much for the call, looking at profit versus product. Oren, where do you see the tension here?
Well, there can be a tension. You know, they can also go hand in hand, that improving quality can be a good pathway to profit. So it's not always a tension, but certainly for some companies it is. I think, you know, one thing that we have to recognize is, of course, if we want manufacturers to grow and invest and employ more people, they're going to have to do it profitably. So I don't think the answer is to sort of lament that they are pursuing profit. But the flip side is that we want to make sure, both within companies and within society generally, that having a job in manufacturing is something that does come with pride. And some of that is the company's responsibility. But there's also, more broadly in society, I think, a problem we have where we've really culturally devalued how we think about a lot of kinds of work. You know, work has gone in kind of the popular imagination from being something that you do because you are expected and have an obligation to be contributing to society, to the community. You do it because you're expected to be supporting your family. And that's that therefore has value and is deserving of respect. And we've shifted more to an idea that work is sort of, you know, supposed to be something that you do because it's self-actualizing and it's your calling and it becomes kind of the center of your life. And if work doesn't do that, then it's bad work or a dead-end job. And I think that's had a really negative effect on how we talk about work in a lot of cases, and how folks who might otherwise take those jobs see them as less worthy of and earning of respect. And so I think we have to kind of have a conversation about that and recognize the damage that we do when we say kind of only certain kinds of work are good work or admirable work or work to be proud of.
And I think Troy in Muskego would like to add to these thoughts as well. Troy, go ahead.
Yes. One thing I noticed in my generation was a shift from a pro-labor to a pro-capitalist or entrepreneur mentality. And one thing I've noticed is that, you know, we used to sell a worker, you know, the blue-collar worker was something to be revered. And you could, like, literally choose to, you know, if your ambition was to maybe raise a family or to, you know, not so much a career, but to just provide and work hard, you could do that. And it's interesting that nowadays it's like the shift has gone to you have to be somehow. And by the way, I've owned a business and I'm actually a laborer right now temporarily. And I noticed that the shift has gone to somehow the significance is in if you could start up a business and chase money, that's what's revered in our society. And I think when I watch TV, I see a lot of programs that are about like the men who built America, which are like the capitalists, but I don't see anything about all the people, the workers, the significance that they actually built America.
Well, let's take a look at Troy's thoughts there. Labor unions and the rise of capitalism from going pro-labor to pro-capitalist.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the TV example is actually a fascinating one and a great way of kind of measuring what's happened in our culture. I mean, you know, a really good example is just to look at sitcoms. And in the 70s and 80s, you know, certainly a lot of our sitcoms, the sitcom that always won the Emmy for best sitcom, it was always about a blue collar family, whether you're talking about All in the Family or Wonder Years or Cheers or Taxi. Those were the stories we were telling about our culture. And they were about the people and their families and their lives. And they happened to have whatever work they had. And we sort of flipped this switch in the early 90s, after which every year the best comedy is about urban white-collar professionals living in New York, Boston, D.C., Seattle, San Francisco, or L.A. And you know, the only exception is The Office. But, of course, The Office was sort of – a lot of the humor was kind of making fun of the pathetic lives and lame work of paper salesmen. And what The Office missed was that – in the show, none of those people have a family, and that's just bizarre. You know, there are hardworking people who sell paper, probably including in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and most of them have families, and they do the work they do during the day to support their family and the other things that are important in their lives. But we seem almost incapable of telling or recognizing that story, and I think that has to be something that we recognize still matters.
Oren, let's take a look at the minimum wage for a moment. Some say raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour would reduce poverty, would grow the economy. Does this type of plan, would that work? Is that the answer, raising the minimum wage?
Well, I think we want wages to go up. The problem with raising the minimum wage is that it essentially attempts to solve the problem by just ordering the labor market to do something different. It says we don't like what wages are. We therefore simply command that you pay more, and that will work for some people, but there are other people who won't work for. And in general, it will actually discourage businesses from building the kinds of businesses and operations that use less skilled workers, who might not be worth $15 an hour. So I think as we talk about kind of how to get wages up, there are two things to focus on. One is what are the actual conditions in our society that are leading to a lot of low wage work? You know, why is it that our education system is incapable of producing People who might not have a college degree but still have real skills and are ready to be productive workers. Why is it that we have regulations that essentially discourage people from building businesses that will employ less skilled workers in productive roles? So we need to tackle those questions. And then if we want to directly raise wages, the policy I prefer is what's called a wage subsidy, which is, it's almost like the opposite of a payroll tax. So if you think about your paycheck, you have that line that says FICA, which is all of those payroll taxes for Social Security being taken out. We could put a line under that that says worker credit, that puts money in and says if you're a low-wage worker, if you're earning $8 an hour, let's say, we're going to put an extra $3 an hour in. And so in a sense, that's like raising the minimum wage, right? We're saying we want to take that job and make it a higher paying job. But it's different in two really important respects. First of all, it says if we want that paycheck to be higher as a society, then it's our responsibility as a society to put that money in. It's not the right answer to just go and find whoever it is. It might be a small business owner just scraping by himself and saying we insist you put that money in. It's all of our problem to address. And secondly, if you do a wage subsidy, you actually make it more attractive to employ less skilled workers and to build those kinds of businesses. And so instead of having a minimum wage that says we're going to make it as unattractive as possible to go that route, we're instead going to say, no, we really value this and we want to see this happen. And we want to see more jobs for folks who are lower skilled and still also make them jobs that pay better. And so I think that's a much better way to approach these problems than, you know, the minimum wage, which sort of sounds easy and free, but it's not. The money still has to come from somewhere and it could have really severe effects that are probably not the ones we want.
And then where does, as we approach a break here, though, but where does international trade and outsourcing jobs fit into this picture as well in perhaps these lower wage positions and going to other countries to get this type of employment?
Well, I think the thing to realize is that we want trade to be balanced, that if you're just talking about consumer welfare, then more trade is better. And if we get lots of cheap stuff from China, that's great. And if we don't even have to send anything back to China in return, so we end up with a big trade deficit, that's even better. And for consumers, it might be. But for workers, it's not. For workers, we need to make sure we have a system where as things, more of the things we consume here might get made elsewhere, that's fine as long as we also make more things here for other people.
Talking with Orrin Cass. He is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research, and his book is The Once and Future Worker, A Vision for the Renewal of Work in America. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you think that your job is contributing to society? Do you feel like you have a fair wage for the work you do? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment on the Ideas Network. Do you think everyone should go to college? Or do you think we should give students more options, more avenues outside of higher ed? 800-642-1234 is the number as we talk about the future worker, the labor market as it is today and for the next generation. And consider this, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 68% of all jobs created from 2016 to 2026 will require post-secondary education. A quarter of American workers need some kind of license, some kind of certificate to do their job today, right now. We're talking with Orrin Cass. His book is The Once and Future Worker. Orrin, let's take a look at higher ed. People generally have this impression that the kids go off to college, they get their bachelor's degree so that they can go and get a good job and provide for themselves. Does that happen? You don't think this is the right move for everyone?
Well, the reality is that it doesn't happen for most people. You know, when we look at kind of our education pipeline, it can look like it's working because most people graduate from high school. Most of those people go on to college. Most people who enroll in college eventually get a degree. Most people who get a degree end up in a job that requires a degree. So that all sounds good. But when you look at the flip side of all those mosts, all the people who are falling out along the way, you end up with about 80% who don't go high school to college to career, and only about 1 in 5 do. So for the people who it works for, that's terrific. But we've built a system that puts all of our effort, all of our resources into this. You know, we've made our high schools into college prep academies. We put more than $100 billion a year into subsidizing higher education. And yet, for the people who that actually works for, you know, those are the people who we sort of think of as the winners, who are headed toward higher paying jobs. And for everybody, either if they don't go to college at all, if they don't complete college, those are the folks that we don't really offer anything to, even though they're the ones who are facing a more challenging labor market. And so I think we've gotten things backwards, and we need to have a much stronger commitment. First of all, we need to have an acknowledgement that not everyone, or even maybe not most people, are headed toward a four-year degree. And then say we need to have a commitment for building a pathway that could be really attractive for those folks, that starts getting them career skills when they're still in high school, that connects them to a job, that maybe supports them as they're initially getting training on the job, and gets them to say, you know, for less than we spend trying to put someone through college, we could get someone to age 20 with, you know, real job experience, an industry credential, some earnings in the bank. And that would be a much better outcome than what's happening now to people who try the college pathway but don't make it.
As we talk about education here, let's go to Aaron joining us from Green Bay with a question. Good morning, Aaron.
Hi, I'm so glad you brought up education, because that's what my question is about. So I'm wondering, because I am a 4-year educated, very low paid worker in a job that needs a bachelor's degree, what's going to happen with the, you know, the social workers and the teachers and the positions that require a lot of higher ed but are still really only getting about $30,000 a year? Will people still be inspired to do those jobs if we could get $30,000 a year as a waitress, if, you know, the $15 an hour for minimum wage was a thing? Thanks.
Aaron, thank you. And what will happen to the teachers, the nurses, the social workers, Oren?
Well, I think, you know, what's going to happen is we're going to see what careers people choose. I mean, if states are able to hire the social workers they need, paying $30,000 a year, then that's probably the salary they're going to offer.
What, you know, the market sounds, bears.
In a sense, and I think it's you know, I don't mean that in sort of the cold, unfeeling economic sense, but I mean in the sense that the decisions that people make, you know, one of the great things about a market is it lets people make their own trade-offs. And so, you know, it sounds like Aaron is well-educated, maybe has a lot of other job options, some of which would pay a lot more than $30,000 a year, but she's chosen to be a social worker. Clearly, there are things she sees valuable about the job outside of the income. And so when you get, if we get to a place where you can't, you know, not enough people want to be teachers at a particular salary, not enough people want to be social workers, then that's where we're going to see those salaries start to go up. But if we have a situation where those are the jobs that people choose, given the mix of salary, how they enjoy the job, the flexibility it might give them, a whole host of factors, those are all part of the equation, as well as the actual dollar wage. And, you know, I suspect, you know, let's say there were a $15 an hour waitressing job for Aaron. I don't think she's still on the line, but I suspect she'd still choose to be a social worker.
Aaron,
and it's wonderful. And it's wonderful that she has that choice.
Well, Aaron, let's hear what would you do?
So I am going back right now to get my master's so that I can get a better paying job within the field. But the problem is that, like, in retrospect, had I had an opportunity that didn't require $50,000 of college debt to make the same amount of money, that's the one that I would have picked. But, you know, working for $5.50 an hour as a waitress isn't possible to still support a family. So that's why I chose the field I did.
And so she's looking back at that hindsight, Aaron, and really seeing the dollars there.
Yeah, well, and I mean, that's a critical point. I think she's exactly right that, you know, the what's broken in this picture might not be that the job pays $30,000 a year. What's broken might be that the pathway to that job required $50,000 of student debt. And so, you know, one question would be, you know, was there, you know, what other higher education options were available, whether it's state university or otherwise, that could have led to the same job without the debt. But even more importantly, is a 4-year college degree that costs, you know, $50,000-$100,000, is that actually money well spent by Aaron or by society in preparing social workers? If we have people who are excited to be social workers and that's the job they want to do, and what they actually need to be prepared to do it looks different than your typical 4-year liberal arts degree, then that might be where we actually need more flexibility in the system too.
So circling back here as we wrap up to public policymakers and people in government who are trying to make these decisions to shift the economy and craft and mold an economy that includes more people, how do you fix this crisis? What are some recommendations you would give to policymakers right now?
Well, I think the critical way to think about it is to recognize that, you know, what the right of center has wanted to do is just sort of say whatever the market does will be great for everybody, and that's not necessarily true. But the left of center view of saying, well, if we don't like what it's doing, we're just going to tell it to do something else, you know, with a high minimum wage, that's probably not actually going to get us where we want either. We really need to look at what are these conditions in our society that are leading us down this path, and which of them can we change? And so we've talked about a lot of them now. We've talked about education and the idea that we really need to put much more of our focus and resources into the pathway for people who aren't headed to a 4-year degree and figure out how to connect them to meaningful work as well. We need to take a look at the way we regulate and say, how do we protect our environment, but at the same time not always choose ever greater environmental quality at the expense of the industrial economy that we need. We need to look at trade and say, we like trade. Trade is good. It benefits consumers. It helps the economy grow, but we need it to be balanced. We need to make sure the international economy is one where other people buy stuff from us when we're buying stuff from them. And then I think organized labor is actually a great thing to talk about, because our system of unions that we set up, you know, in the 1930s isn't working very well right now. Most workers say it's not what they want, but some form of organized labor would be terrific. And there are, you know, other countries, for instance, do it very differently. And we need to find a way to give workers the ability to organize, to create organizations that allow them to support each other, that allow them to collaborate and interact with management, but do it in a way that empowers them and helps them become more productive too.
Oren, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Oren Kass is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research. He previously worked as the domestic policy director for Mitt Romney's presidential bid. And as an editor of the Harvard Law Review, his new book is The Once and Future Worker, A Vision for the Renewal of Work in America. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.